Sagar and Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
And even though I sometimes use the expression myself, woke capitalism, I have to admit I cringe every time when I sort of say it because, you know, well, first of all,
it's the title word, of the book. So you
I mean, the title of the book is Woke Incorporated. And right. You know, I have to say that the word woke itself has had a bit of a journey. I actually think that there is a certain, at least intellectual coherence to examining pre-existing power structures. Critical theory is all about examining the prevailing power structures and revealing them for what they are. I think that there's a worthy endeavor there. That's not inherently pejorative, although it's taken on this inherently pejorative connotation on the right. It wasn't at least when I named the book, but I stand by the title of the book because I actually think that has created a new power structure, by the way, in our country that is now the unidentified power structure. If to the extent that systemic racism exists, that is a power structure that is no longer a secret. It is called out every day and you'd have to have your head in the sand to expect that it didn't exist.
Excited to bring you an amazing guest today, Vivek Ramaswamy. He is the author of the forthcoming book, Woke Inc. Now, before anybody gets mad over here, this is not some typical culture war episode. Vivek is the founder of Rovient, which is a multi-billion-dollar biotech company. In addition to that, he was the CEO. Now he's the chairman. He was on the cover of Forbes magazine. For our purposes, Vivek is somebody who both cares about woke capitalism, but also, instead of just complaining about it like a typical take-haver, he has a lot of interesting ideas about what to do, reforms in corporate governance law, shareholder capitalism. His perspective is one I find uniquely and interesting to this actual debate.
Yeah, I love an episode where I come in with a perspective and I kind of not exactly change my opinion, but reconfigure how I'm approaching something. So it turns out I actually totally disagree with him around the idea that companies shouldn't take stands on non-business issues. Under his argument, he doesn't just have beef with companies saying they're doing BLM or other political things in the US. He also doesn't think stuff that's happening in Hong Kong or Taiwan or China are things that should be addressed by companies that have shareholder owners. I disagree with that. Sagar disagrees with that. So it's always fun to take an issue, see it through a different lens, understand, wait a second, what is my actual beef with woke capitalism? And Sagar, I think your quote was, wait a second, I kind of do want companies to be woke, but just in a different direction.
Yeah, I'm like, wait, I don't want woke capitalism. I want pro-American capitalism. Like, I want like boomer flags all over my merchandise. And I think most of the country does too. But hey, what do I know? Vivek has an interesting rebuttal to all of that. And anyway, I think he's one of the more interesting thinkers out there on this topic. I learned a lot from him.
Yeah, and his book is going to be available on August 17th. So, of course, go to our bookshop link. You can check it out there, which will be in our Substack, which is going out this Thursday. We took a pause last week, but we will have all of the making up and all of the book recommendations you all have been asking for. That link is available in our show notes right below here. And speaking of recommendations, we have loved having everyone send in their recommendations. We're taking a bit of a pause on Q&A right now and are honestly just looking for more audience feedback and statements that are interesting and speak to what we're doing. So for today's episode, we are getting this from BWISC. This is coming from Apple Podcasts. The way you could submit a comment or a question, frankly, is you can email us at realignmentpod@gmail.com or you could leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. This comment is, love the pod. Love that you guys are both open-minded and willing to give other people the benefit of the doubt. I'd love to hear you speak with someone like Richard Wolff or Jeffrey Sachs. Get really into the weeds about economic leftism and what would/wouldn't work. My book recommendation is Killing Hope by William Bloom. It's been quite an eye-opening read about our Cold War history.
Yeah, look, I've talked to Richard Wolff a bunch of times on Rising. That one would be interesting. He's a very doctrinaire Marxist, so I'm not sure how that would fly here. I don't think he really believes in realignment. Jeffrey Sachs is someone I would consider. Sachs, in my estimation, is a either unwitting and perhaps witting tool of the CCP and really has pushed things in a direction which I find unconscionable in American academia. So yeah, maybe we should invite him on to debate him a little bit because I think he's probably one of the most pernicious forces in the elite world who's pushing for, you know, quote unquote, accommodationism with China. That being said, I actually admired the guy over a decade ago for a lot of the sustainability work that he was doing. He was one of the first people I know who was pushing some of that. There actually is a strange brain cancer that seems to come where if you care about climate change, then apparently confronting China, the number one polluter on the planet by a country mile, is apparently the wrong thing to do, shouting out the Sunrise Movement here. So yeah, maybe we just got an idea, Marshall. I don't know.
Yeah, let's just hope that his publisher does not listen to episodes when it comes to those.
Because his publisher wants to sell books, Mr. Sachs. So if you want to come over here, we sell a lot of books on this channel.
You heard it here first. This has been our worst ever guest pitch solicitation, but you know how it goes. We love doing books here, so we're more than happy to have Jeffrey Sachs keep these recommendations going. It's August, so it's a bit of a slow month for the show and just for everyone. So we're definitely looking to get on everyone's radar going into the fall. Well, huge thank you, of course, to Lincoln Network. Shout out to Lincoln Network's conference that they're running with us for the Realignment podcast. There's also a Peter Thiel event a few days before. All this is linked in the show notes. Go check it out. Let's just get to the episode. A lot of great stuff here.
Vivek Ramaswamy, welcome to the Realignment.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Vivek, I've followed you for a while. I've been seeing some talk about your new forthcoming book, Woke Inc. We're going to have a pre-order there in the description notes. But I think it's important that we kind of set the frame of the discussion, just like, who are you? Give us a little bit of background on what exactly you've done. You founded this company, Roivant. You were on the cover of Forbes. But now you describe yourself as a class trader. First of all, just tell us a little about yourself. And tell us what class trader means to you. A lot of people use that term. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, sure. So I'll give you the 2-minute version of my background. Grew up in Cincinnati, Ohio. Parents were both immigrants from India. My dad worked in GE in Evendale, Ohio. So that's part of why we ended up there. He was a career guy. I went to public schools through 8th grade and then went to a Jesuit high school. I'm Hindu, not Catholic, but I went to a Catholic private high school. And, you know, I think that began to shape my worldview, actually, on even some of the questions that I talk about in my book. But anyway, I went to Harvard and thought I was going to be a scientist. I studied molecular biology. I was one of the nerdy guys in the lab the whole time. I had an itch that I had never really fully scratched at the intersection of law and politics, though. And so, you know, when I graduated, I joined a hedge fund in New York. I was a biotech investor, had some success doing that. 3 years in, I told my bosses that I really needed to go scratch this other itch. So I decided to go to law school at Yale. They did something interesting. And it was actually a career lesson that I learned, which was they said, keep your job. We want you to keep the job, manage a portfolio for us. So that actually got me career autonomy at the same time as I got to do something I wanted to do. So I became a relatively autonomous investor in biotech at this hedge fund, but at the same time was having a grand old time at law school at Yale. Probably the most tangible thing is I met my wife. She was my next door neighbor. She was in med school. So it's probably the most tangible thing that came out of it because I never practiced law. It's never my goal. But when I came back to my job as an investor, I was kind of, by that point, flat on the learning curve. So I left to start the biotech company that you mentioned, Sagar, Roivant. And the goal of Roivant was really to challenge what I thought was a bureaucratic model in big pharma that just took too darn long to develop drugs. And yes, they blame the FDA, rightly. And yes, they blame inherent scientific risks, rightly. But there was a third element that involved behavioral issues in big pharma and in the bureaucracy of big pharma that I thought I could address with a new model. And so I started a company, set out with a bold vision. It's easier said than done, as I learned pretty quickly. The first drug we developed was a massive failure for Alzheimer's disease. But thankfully, we had enough other drugs in the pipeline and enough resources to back it up that eventually the company went on to be a, you know, if I may say, something of a success in the end. It's a multi-billion dollar company today. I served as CEO through this January, but for some of the reasons I describe in my book, as I waded into addressing not prostate cancer, which is one of the drugs for which the company developed a product that's now approved today, but a cultural cancer that was really contentious, it became increasingly untenable for me to protect the company from the things that I was saying while also saying them, even though I was speaking as a citizen. So this January, I stepped down as CEO. I remained chairman of the company, but put a new guy in charge who had been my longtime deputy, and he runs the company today. And I'm squarely focused on addressing what I see as reviving an American cultural agenda that I think we need to grapple with.
Interesting.
So let's get to the class traitor part, because this is on the blurb for the book. So this is the part that is being put out here. So when you talk about class, you're obviously referring to what I would say your educational background. It's not just the fact that you've been a successful business person, investor, et cetera. It's the fact that you went to these elite institutions, and you're arguing with what you're pushing back when it comes to various degrees of wokeness. You're pushing back against that. But something our more left-leaning listeners are going to wonder about is class traitor, especially in FDR, Theodore Roosevelt's context, really referred to economic issues. So before we get a little deeper, where do you really stand on a lot of the big economic questions of capitalism that people used to refer to when they said class traitor?
Yeah, okay, good. So this is good stuff. So what I mean when I say I'm a traitor to my class, which I believe is like the opening line of my book, if I'm remembering it correctly, or close, is that I wasn't born as an elite American, but I'm an elite American today. I'm the founder of multi-billion dollar companies. I've lived the full arc of the American dream. I've been at the top of Harvard and Yale and everywhere in between. I'm an elite American. And I think that there are certain expectations for the views you're allowed to have as an elite American today, or more precisely, the views you're allowed to express as an elite American today. And I think that one of the things that I viewed as my role, I grew up in a small town in Ohio. I'm back in a small town in Ohio for the last couple of years, close to where I grew up, is that I think that my neighbors here better understand the essence of the American soul, better understand the American Constitution than my classmates at Yale Law School, but may lack the parlance, the lexicon, the vocabulary, the conceptual vocabulary to engage in debates with elite America about their point of view. And I view my role a little bit as building that bridge to provide a voice for the intuitions of the kind of people who I grew up with, but to engage in debate and if I may say, to win in those debates with the people who have been in my surroundings for the last 15 years rather than the first 20 years of my life. Now, that doesn't answer your second question, Marshall, but I can come back to that later.
Well, no, go ahead and answer it actually, because I have something else. Yeah.
So I'll be quick about it then, Sagar, because the second question he asked is where do I come out? Just so we kind of know where we're all situated coming into the conversation. Now, not to say that there's tight boxes where somebody has to be confined into a particular political category, but I get where you're coming from, Marshall. So I would say that I'm a lover of capitalism. I love capitalism. I love our system of free enterprise. I do think that the free market that the 1980 conservative idealized doesn't actually exist today. And that's probably the defining question for the future of the conservative movement, which has spent 40 years defending the castle of capitalism from the front door, that they totally missed it when that castle was invaded through the back door. And now they have the challenge of how they sterilize the castle without burning the whole thing down. That's a really hard thing. And I think we should talk about it. But to your question about where I'm coming from, in a certain sense, I am a lover of capitalism, but I also learned to be wary of it, right? I told you I joined a hedge fund out of college. Well, I graduated in the fall. I graduated in 2007, joined in the fall of 2007, right before the 2008 financial crisis, which no doubt influenced my views of capitalism and make me skeptical of capitalism when it becomes intermingled with politics, or for that matter, intermingled with other spheres of our lives. And so while I don't identify with the left, which says that the major problem with capitalism is the distribution of money in a society, I think it's coherent. I can engage with that. I don't personally identify that as my personal viewpoint. I think that the real problem with capitalism is almost a critique, what I'll call a critique from the right for me, which is actually limiting the scope of what money itself can buy. So I don't care if Jeff Bezos or Richard Branson or whoever can buy their sixth space car, that's fine with me, or sixth beach home for that matter, because that's just the realm of things. It's material stuff. It's boring, right? I mean, I spent my childhood summers in a remote village in India where we didn't have a lot of those comforts and, you know, whatever. I have stuff today, but it's just stuff. Who cares? What I begin to care is when the scope of what money itself can buy begins to expand to include the things that money shouldn't be able to buy, especially in a democracy or in a family or in a church or in a religion. And so that's kind of where I'm coming from.
So let's dig down into that, because I think that's probably the most interesting ideas that I've seen you put forward. What are the specific social pathologies that you're trying to target in terms of this critique of capitalism? So when we're talking about, like you said, money buying, I mean, can money buy an idea? Can money buy speech? Obviously, I mean, I have my own answers on this. I think people know where I stand, but I'd like to hear your articulation of both the current iteration of the problem and then your explanation for how we got here, because I think that's even more important for thinking about how we get out of it.
Yep. So complicated stuff. And this is sort of what the whole, that's why it takes a book to talk about, but we'll do a short version of it here. So I think that the scope of what money can buy has expanded, but the scope of what money ought to buy ought to be actually much more constrained. And so I think that the use of money to exercise power in the marketplace of products is something I'm totally fine with. That, you know, I just check my phone. Okay, well, what's the shape of this phone? $1, one vote is a perfect system to decide whether this phone gets voted to the top or this phone gets voted to the top. And the marketplace of products decides that. Okay, I'm fine with that. But $1, one vote, and it's, by the way, it's even fine for voting in the marketplace of corporate America, determining who gets elected to, this is an Apple phone, gets elected to Apple's board of directors. It's not like everyone who owns a share of Apple gets an equal choice in that manner. It's that the people who own the most shares get the greatest say. That's $1, one vote. That's how capitalism works. I'm cool with that. But I'm not cool with it when that rule then begins to infect American democracy, which is supposed to work according to a different rule, which is one person, one vote, one person, one voice, really. It's not just the physical act of casting a ballot every November. That's one of the things I think the left gets wrong. That's not what democracy is about. It's part of democracy. That's not everything about democracy. Democracy is about one person, one voice in our democracy. And so when we violate that principle by saying that our most important normative questions and moral questions ought to be adjudicated, not where in a marketplace of ideas where everyone's voice is weighted equally, but behind closed doors where a small group of CEOs and investors say get to tell the rest of the world what they ought to think, like BlackRock, the largest asset manager in the world, or Goldman Sachs, the leading investment bank that decides what companies get to go public or not in the United States. That's a real problem that looks to me a lot like old world Europe, where a bunch of church leaders and business leaders and elites used to get together behind a closed door and decide what was good for the rest of society. Maybe that's the best version of Europe. It ain't the best version of America. And I think it's that perversion that really led me to, you know, want to call out this issue from the inside.
Let's get very specific then.
Okay.
What are the specific things that money is buying today under our system that you think it shouldn't be allowed to buy and you're inferring in previous eras didn't buy?
Okay, so the bounds of acceptable debate, that's top of the list for me. The bounds of what ideas can and can't be aired in the public square, both with respect to the people who wield perhaps the greatest market control in the United States today, big tech, Silicon Valley, Twitter, Facebook, Google, everything in between, to also what's happening in the workplace, the use of economic power as a bludgeon to be able to fire someone like James Damore in 2017 or countless other politically motivated firings since then that force everyday Americans to make a choice now between, perversely, between putting food on the dinner table and saying what they are able to actually think. Effectively, to me, it's between the American dream and the First Amendment. And to me, America is a place that doesn't force you to make a choice between those ideals. It is the place, the quintessential place, where you get to enjoy both of those things at once. And so to me, the bounds of acceptable speech at home, online, I'm not even saying at work. Many people are fired for the kinds of things that they're saying outside of work. That's an inappropriate violation of our democratic norms. And I think that the use of force to supplant free speech and open debate, whether it's violent force or economic force, is a perversion of what America is supposed to stand for.
You know, Vivek, I do have a question on this. By the way, I've always been deeply concerned about this and more. But as I looked into it, at a certain point, are we more worried about a elite phenomenon? And what I mean by that is that, is this not a crisis of the elite? I don't know a lot of, I have not seen. And I've seen, you know, the canceled profiles or whatever that Killette and them have done of like warehouse workers being fired for their views or like somebody working at McDonald's. It's always in elite institutions. And so on the one hand, I mean, look, we're all products of the elite here. We all run in elite circles. Like, let's be real. So it is obviously a problem for us. Is it a problem for the everyday American? Because I think that's one of the probably the fairest critiques around like,
so why do you live, guys, man?
Care so much? So I live in D.C. So like, this is a problem for me.
Like, and I'm in Williamsburg, right? Like, we're on the Acela.
Where do you live, Marshall?
Yeah. Williamsburg, like Brooklyn. Right. So we're in a very specific space.
I made an intentional decision ahead of having a kid. And, you know, I knew I didn't want to raise him in Manhattan. We, in 2019, came back to Ohio. I just disagree with your characterization there, Sagar. I think it is a problem amongst elite circles. There are plenty of issues that are figments of elite creation, that are navel-gazing issues that need to be adjudicated in those corridors. I don't think this is one of them. I think this is an issue that touches and actually harms most the people who don't have elite toolkits to be able to contend with it. I don't think the problem is an elite problem. I think my solution to doing it, writing a book after being a wealthy founder of successful companies, doesn't really. I mean, people tell me I'm really brave for writing this book. I don't feel particularly brave for writing it. I have an audience on cable news. You guys contact me to do the podcast. I have a voice to be able to speak, and I'm chairman of the company I founded. Yeah, I stepped aside as CEO. It was some measure of sacrifice. And in the context of my life, it wasn't easy. But compared to the struggle that a lot of people face, it's nothing. But I do think that a lot of everyday Americans who do need to put food on the dinner table have to think twice before they say what they say at work or they say what they say at home. I mean, look, I got involved with a case earlier this year with a family that I had, if I may say, for me, the privilege of supporting in a small way, financially or otherwise, that faced an issue in school where her son did not want to go through the catechism of confessing his white privilege. The irony is he wasn't even fully white, though his teacher didn't seem to appreciate that fact. He didn't want to do it. He got a bad grade at school, risked his ability to go to college. And this wasn't a wealthy family. This is a poor family. This wasn't a coastal family. This was a non-coastal family. And so I think that I disagree with your characterization. I think it is a rampant problem. Not that the number of firings are so high, but there had to be enough, or the number of people who were penalized with a bad grade with school was so high, but they were visible enough that everybody operates in the shadow of that possibility. And your latitude of the risk that you can take, as fragile as you might feel in your elite bubble or our elite bubbles, actually, we actually have much more latitude to take risk than the kind of people who might actually may not have either the economic or educational latitude and the margin for error to be able to defect from what has increasingly become an ideological cartel. So respectfully, I just made this.
No, it's good. The school example is a very good one, actually. It's a useful counter to I'm talking about.
But this is what's interesting, Marshall, though, which is that let's get to your central beef here, especially if you read your Wall Street Journal pieces, it's really with this idea of stakeholder capitalism. So could you explain for the audience in your most good faith way possible what stakeholder capital, and then please attack, do everything like that. But
I think it's best done as an exploration rather than as an attack. And so
let me be precise though. I want, because I set this up this way, define it, but then please give your full throat.
I'll give my view after that. Fine, I'll define it and then give my view of it.
Yeah.
So stakeholder capitalism is the idea that the purpose of a corporation and a business is not just to serve its shareholders, but to serve all stakeholders of the business, including those who aren't shareholders as well. It was born in the 1970s, when Klaus Schwab was sort of a rival intellectual leader to Milton Friedman, who argued that the sole purpose of the firm was to maximize profit for the firm. So you asked me to give the fairest shake. Let me really give the fairest shake here to the case for stakeholder capitalism. One that, by the way, Milton Friedman did a poor job, in my opinion, of taking into account in his critique. The fairest shake is that the corporation could not exist without certain gifts that society legally bestows upon the owners of corporations. Foremost among them, the great gift of limited liability, which says that unlike an ordinary person, the three of us as individuals, the owners of a corporation have a really special corporate privilege, to borrow the lexicon of the moment, which says that actually, if you do something as via a corporation, you as the owner or the shareholder can't be sued, or else nobody would want to start a company. That was the logic. So that was a great gift that society bestowed upon shareholders. And so stakeholder capitalists basically say that, okay, in light of that and other interesting gifts that society bestows upon corporate shareholders, there's an unspoken grand bargain where we expect something in return. Yeah, you need to maximize profits for yourselves to create the incentives to unleash a technological revolution and the industrial revolution and so forth. But we all understood that the bargain at the very beginning was that, okay, you also owe some debt back to society that you're supposed to pay back. Milton Friedman rejected that idea, but never offered a good concrete case for why society would have bestowed these great gifts upon corporate shareholders if it weren't for some sort of quid in return for that quo. I actually think the stakeholder capitalists get it right in saying that there was an unspoken grand bargain at the inception of the American corporation. I just think the grand bargain was different. I think the grand bargain wasn't an unspoken grand bargain. It was an explicit grand bargain codified in the same law or the same kind of law that gave limited liability to shareholders. Corporate law also did another thing. It said that if you're on the board of directors of a corporation, the thing and the sole thing you're supposed to take into account is the pursuit of profit for those shareholders, maximizing profit or maximizing total return for shareholders. Now, that's counterintuitive for a second. You're like, oh, aren't both of those gifts to shareholders? The answer is no, actually. One of those is a demand that society made on corporations to say that if we're going to make you so powerful with this special shield of limited liability, then you better stay, Frankenstein, in your cage downstairs in that basement, or else you're going to rove free and roam free on American terrain that you should not touch. And so to me, that was actually the explicit grand bargain at the birth of the corporation, that we don't want the Dutch East India Company in the United States, which had a military, it had its own coins, it had its own hospitals, it had its own schools through its philanthropy. It was sort of a quasi-state of its own time. And the American vision was, we don't want the Dutch East India Company here. We just want corporations that make things for people. That's great. Stay in your lane and leave the rest of us, be it the democracy or the church or any other, or the family alone. So that's sort of the school of thought that I come from. And that's my critique, which is different than Milton Friedman's, which is that stakeholder capitalism makes companies less efficient. Okay, there might've been some truth to that. My critique is the opposite. I actually think that I don't worry about politics infecting capitalism. I worry about capitalism infecting politics.
Yeah.
Let me set this up then, because I think this is really fascinating, especially when you read between the lines of what you're suggesting here. So I believe this was from your New York Post excerpt. We'll put all this in the show notes. You specifically operationalized the stepping outside of the basement part as companies taking stands. An example would be companies taking stands on social, cultural, political issues like outside of their direct thing. So my question for you is along two different lines. So one, what happens in situations where taking those political, social, cultural stands actually enhances shareholder value? So Sure. The example of this is just Nike and Colin Kaepernick. We live in a incredibly, not just bifurcated, but an America that's broken up into all these different markets, all these different niches. This isn't the 1950s. This isn't the 60s. You're not on NBC, ABC, CBS trying to sell to everyone. You're trying to say, hey, I work at Nike. We want to raise our margins. We're going to start selling to upper middle class, college educated to graduate school educated people who want to spend $200 on running shoes for a lifestyle purpose. Guess what? That market actually is very socially liberal. That market actually would say, hey, this brand that puts Colin Kaepernick on their big ad in Times Square is a brand that I want to associate with. A brand I would not want to associate, for example, could be, I think it was either New Balance or Reebok, which like randomly,
New Balance,
like,
I think is what, yeah, you meant. Yep.
Random like skinheads in England started associating themselves with New Balance. So people could be like, well, I don't want to wear that brand because it's unfashionable. No offense, New Balance. I really like your stuff. I've actually got New Balance stuff in the closet.
It's good brand.
The point is though, what do you say to the Nike executive who says, look, our shareholder value was enhanced by taking a stand because we are marketing to an America. Vivek, you're accusing us of dividing America when actually we're doing it in the exact reverse. There's a divided America that demands to be marketed to, that demands an identity from brands.
Yeah.
So we're going to market to that.
You're hitting on a great point, Marshall. So, you know, of course, no action is in a vacuum. There's a discursive effect. There's a dialectic. There's a relationship. There's feedback loops that are complicated. But I think the easiest way to start is maybe through some definitional clarity. At this point, actually, having written a book on it, And even though I sometimes use the expression myself, woke capitalism, I have to admit, I cringe every time when I sort of say it because, you know, well, first of all,
it's the title of the book. So you
know. I mean, the title of the book is Woke Incorporated. And right. You know, I have to say that the word woke itself has had a bit of a journey. I actually think that there is a certain, at least intellectual coherence to examining pre-existing power structures. The critical theory is all about examining the prevailing power structures and revealing them for what they are. I think that there's a worthy endeavor there. That's not inherently pejorative, although it's taken on this inherently pejorative connotation on the right. It's not when it wasn't, at least when I named the book, but I stand by the title of the book because I actually think that has created a new power structure, by the way, in our country that is now the unidentified power structure. If to the extent that systemic racism exists, that is a power structure that is no longer a secret. It is called out every day and you'd have to have your head in the sand to expect that it didn't exist. But the power structure that needs to be called out is the power structure that actually posits the theory of systemic racism at all, or the woke power structure. So anyway, that's my little side rant. To answer your question, I think there are three kinds of woke capitalism, okay, or stakeholder capitalism. You could use them interchangeably for our conversation. One would be in the category of the woke stakeholderist executives, okay? And there the victim might actually be their shareholders, where they say that, hey, I am finally in charge. I'm CEO, finally, and I'm going to use it. I only live once. I've met people like this. And this is what I believe. This is the right thing to do. And by hell or high water, I'm the CEO and I'm going to do it. Using corporate resources to do it. There, the shareholder might be the victim, okay? Because they're using shareholder resources to, you know, if a CEO, by the way, were to make a donation to their high school or their temple, somehow everyone acknowledges that would be a little icky and something wrong, but somehow if they donate to a different temple, call it Black Lives Matter, there's really no problem with that. But anyway, that's the problem of the woke executive. The victim might be the shareholder. That's different than what we're actually beginning to see is Gen 2, is a lot of shareholders saying, no, we're the shareholders. You work for us, darn right. But you, the executive, better advance these social values or else. That's BlackRock. Small note, that's actually Larry Fink, which is back to the problem of the woke executive. It's not actually the people whose money BlackRock's managing, but let's put that distinction to one side. It might be the sovereign wealth fund of Norway or the sovereign wealth fund of Saudi Arabia, for that matter, who has a very different vision of what values need to be advanced relative to the sovereign wealth fund of Norway. But that is the investor themselves that's saying, hey, we want you to advance these values. They're not the victim anymore. They're actually the agent. If you think it's bad, they're the perpetrator. That is different still. Both of those are top down though, right? Investors and CEOs are both, Sagar, to your point, elites. Okay.
Yep.
That's different than the bottom, they're top down. That's different than the bottom up phenomenon that Marshall's asking about, which is what I call the phenomenon of woke consumerism. And there, I don't fault the executive or the investor or the business as a whole that meets the consumer where they are or meets the consumers where they are. But I do think that is an indictment of where we are in our culture as a country, where I'm just looking at you guys on screen. We all seem like we're millennials. Are you guys millennials?
Yeah.
Okay. We're all millennials.
Like 29. Yeah.
You're 29. Okay. I'm like an older millennial. I'm 35. What are you, Marshall?
29. So
29. All right. You guys are okay. I mean, look, I believe we're part of a generation that is hungry for a cause, that is hungry for purpose, that is hungry for meaning, hungry for identity. And the things that used to fill that moral vacuum in generations prior, things like patriotism, faith, hard work, have now been supplanted by new postmodern philosophies. But at least, let's just say the patriotism's on the decline, faith has nearly disappeared. That leaves a moral vacuum in its wake. And when you have a black hole that runs that deep, that's part of what makes wokeism so appealing as an alternative version of opium for the masses. And I think that the mixing of morality with commercialism is such a thin way of filling a moral void that requires far more substantial fare, that we're just using this as the equivalent of fast food to fill ourselves up as well for a moral hunger that runs far deeper. And so, you know, sometimes I think a shirt is just a shirt. I think this, or whatever brand this is, maybe Banana Republic, you know, whatever that is, great. A shirt's just a shirt. It doesn't have to come with a teaspoon of morality on the side, or a cup of ice cream is just a cup of ice cream. You can get it from Ben and Jerry's without a little bit of morality on top. And this mix between commercialism and morality, I don't think is necessarily the error of the company that then plays a role in serving that demand. But I do think collectively is an indictment of our cultural hunger for a cause that we just have to find a different way to satisfy than with commercialism alone.
I completely agree with you. I remember there was a Ross Douthat piece maybe 5 years ago, which basically nailed this exact dynamic about the religiosity of wokeism, about how it can fill a millennial void. I do want to get to something which I struggle really hard with on this, Vivek, which is that I am repulsed, just like a lot of people, when I see genuflecting by these Fortune 500 companies for causes which I know they either do legitimately believe and that's a problem, or don't, but are, you know, doing it for shareholder value. Both of them annoy the shit out of me. Here's the problem. In a way, though, I'm just mad that they're not doing what I want. And what I mean by that is that I actually want patriotic companies. So what I mean by that is I actually want Fortune 500 companies in America to stand up and say, we're not buying slave cotton from Xinjiang. That actually is something which is going to hurt their bottom line. So, like, in a way, I want those companies. I mean, look, I want these companies to, you know, sign an athlete who is just unabashedly pro-America, flag waving in the most like boomer way, and make that part of our culture. I think that's a good thing. That's kind of like, I like the kitschy, you know, got the flag behind me. So, like, how, here's my question. Can we, at the end of the day, we're a free country. You went to Yale Law and all this. Is it possible to have the companies that I want? We don't buy slave cotton. We're proud of it, even if it costs us money. We're pro-America. We're going to fly the Taiwanese flag and make Taiwanese uniforms, even if it costs us money. And also still have to deal with, it's annoying. Like Ben and Jerry's apparently has to have a stance on the West Bank, right? Like,
you're asking a good question, right? So I'm going to give you parsing my intuitions versus my principles on this. My intuitions are right there with you, right? I call myself a non-white nationalist. I'm an American through and through, based on ideals, not based on skin deep identity. And, you know, I have an American flag in my front yard. You got yours on your back. zoom background here. So that being said, though, that's not necessarily to me the solution. I think the solution is just greater honesty and openness and transparency about what global companies actually stand for. I mean, for Facebook, the First Amendment isn't an American value like it is to most citizens. It's a pesky local ordinance from the vision of a global company. I'll tell you a story actually that's actually the Wall Street Journal did detail, but isn't super well known even still, about Airbnb. All right. Airbnb wanted to do business in China. China made a demand, as they often do, that if you want to enter this country, there's a great Chinese wall in front of you. And if you want to get over the Great Wall, you're going to have to hand over data of American consumers. And so they post a neat little black square on their Instagram account, or whatever it is they do, whatever declaration of the data is making to stand with Black Lives Matter, or serving stakeholders rather than shareholders if you're Brian Chesky. Yet they don't include on their list of stakeholders the CCP. So there was this guy, Sean Joyce, who actually became their chief privacy officer. I think that was almost exactly his title. And he resigned over it, where he said that we're not really telling our consumers here that we're handing over their data, their private messages, right? The equivalent of emails through the app are getting handed over to the CCP. We're not telling them. I'm resigning because I don't believe that that's what an American company like Airbnb should be doing. And Nate Blacharczyk, who's, you know, I think it was like a year or two ahead of me at Harvard when we overlapped there, is now like a co-founder of Airbnb, is recorded according to the Wall Street Journal story to say that we're not here to promote American values. He says that behind doors to Brian Chesky and Sean Joyce. Sean Joyce resigns. Now, I just want to parse that statement for a second, because I think that may be the difference between me and you on this, at least my intuition's with you, but my principles and where you're at. My principles say that's okay. That's a perfectly legitimate thing for a company to say, even a company that bases its headquarters in America, is that we're not here to promote American values. I don't know that I love that in my heart, but it's a legitimate thing for a company to say in the open.
Yep.
But don't dupe everybody in the process by saying that you stand with Black Lives Matter, duping progressive consumers to hand over their data in troves, post a neat little chart of who your stakeholders are, where you don't mention the CCP or say a peep about what you do in China, and then sell us dry as you use it as your bribe, dirty bribe, to enter the Chinese market. That's the institutional dishonesty that I'm really taking aim at in the book. And I think that's the institutional dishonesty that has sowed an epidemic of institutional mistrust in America, where people have been, the lying has been so rampant that if we were all just open and transparent about it, the American system, the combination of democracy and capitalism, actually works pretty darn well if we can see with a clear eye what's actually going on. But the new breed of woke smoke actually deflects accountability for the kinds of things that betray American consumers and leave them hanging high and dry, even with respect to companies that don't have to be bleeding red, white, and blue. I think we ought to be bleeding red, white, and blue in our capacity as citizens, not necessarily in our capacity as consumers. Mm-hmm. And to me, part of American pluralism isn't just the visible tableau of diversity in a given room, but is the pluralism of identities within each of us. And to me, I'm a father, I'm a man, I'm an Indian American, I'm religious, I'm a tennis player, I'm a citizen, and I'm a consumer. And those are two different aspects of my personhood that one of them bleeds red, white, and blue, and the other one bleeds dollars. And I think that that's okay as long as we're able to keep those straight. So that's where I'm a little bit different than you.
No, that's that's good articulation.
Yeah, and what's interesting here is you're getting to, I think, what my core disagreement here would be, which is that, I said this a little earlier, but I just really think that the individualism and the breaking apart of society came before anything that we could critique as woke. I think that's just a fact. It's a fact of the internet. It's the fact of us no longer living in gray flannel suit America from the 1950s. There are benefits to that. There are costs to that. And from my perspective, I don't see a world where we put the genie back in the bottle again, because, like, once again, I get how you are saying you don't believe that brands should be taking stands on things. But actually, if a shoe company were to say, we just saw what happened in Hong Kong, or let's say China invades Taiwan, and they say, you know what, we are leaving the Chinese market, this is going to increase our prices by $50 a shoe, I would buy 10 pairs of those shoes. And there's a lot of people like me too.
Same.
I think that's just the reality of the society we live in. And that's why I appreciate what Sagar was saying. And please push back on all this, because what I'm just trying to get at is that we just live in a world where our individual tastes and our individual perspectives are going to be catered to. And there's nothing that we could fundamentally do about that. So
this is, Marshall, where I'm going upstream, though, is that, and this is why I no longer call myself a libertarian. Most policies I support tend to be kind of libertarian-ish policies. I used to call myself a libertarian. I don't anymore, because the scope of libertarianism is so limited to the relationship between the state and the individual, with complete agnosticism to what all these beautifully free people do in that free society once we're all free. And to me, I think that, well, this is just what we want, is a fine description as an alibi for a company's CEO to take a particular stand and say that they've got to go to where the consumers are and meet the consumers where they are. That's fine. But I'm not agnostic to the upstream question on whether the consumers themselves are misguided, where we have an entire generation that has a moral vacuum that wants to express its morality through who they buy their shoes from. And and this is something I talk about in the book too. It probably will be the parts of the book that get less play because they're in the second half. But you know, I think that we had to have a revived conversation about, you know, Americans who realize and earn their citizenship by playing a role in serving the country at a young age, in a time where I think part of the reason why we have both woke capitalists and woke consumers is that by the time we graduate from high school, we've already been conditioned in a society that teaches us that service and self-interest have to be intermingled. That the reason I did this, I don't know about you guys, I mean, I did this when I was in high school, community service. The reason you did it is you want to put it on your college application to get into a good college. And then you go to Yale Law School. And the reason you participate in the public interest auction, you know, I didn't do this, but a lot of my peers did, was to get dinner with a professor that can write you a good recommendation so that you can get your clerkship. And then you show up at Wachtell Lipton to be a lawyer making a seven-figure partner salary to declare the benefits of stakeholder capitalism in the modern version of corporate law. It's no surprise that we live in a world where people have never built the muscle memory of either pursuing self-interest or pursuing service as an end in itself. And now we have a bastardized version of both, where we're actually doing neither by trying to combine each with the other. And maybe if you're a consumer, a shirt should just be a shirt. And maybe if you're pursuing the pursuit of profit as an investor or a CEO, a dollar is just a dollar, but that doesn't negate the fact that there's a different sphere of our lives as citizens, as human beings, where we serve one another as a country and as fellow citizens and as fellow human beings, that we don't need to intermingle with the pursuit of profit itself. So I think that that to me, when we live in a state of the world where we say, well, I don't want to buy from that company and I do want to buy from that company and that's where I'm going to get my shirt because that matches my values. I guess I have a skeptical take on how deep one's values really run when they're so ready to express them through skin deep, cheap commercial acts. It's not to say that a certain person couldn't approach that in a deeper lens, but I think that's the exception rather than the rule. And that's, I think, a conversation that we ought to have. That the first half of my book, by the way, if it were that were all there were to it, would just leave a lot on the table that were unaddressed. And I think those are actually the deeper, harder questions that we ought to, on both sides of this debate, grapple with.
I'm curious for your response to the anti-woke progressive response to this critique. And I see this a lot, given my co-host Crystal, which is that what she would say, and to a certain extent, I do kind of agree with this, is Sagar, the reasons that we have woke corporations and that all these people have the power is because we have an unequal distribution of capital in our society. Therefore, all these consumer products like Nike and more, you will always make billions of dollars catering to the whims of just 20% of the population because the income graph, for those who are listening, you know, goes this way and the top 20% of our population holds, I don't know, 50, 60% or whatever of the wealth. And so the actually, this is a good example. Black Rifle Coffee. So Black Rifle Coffee, you know, brands itself. They're like pro-America. I'm a big fan of Black Rifle and Evan, who I'm
Starbucks for Republicans, you know, whatever.
Yes, yeah. I'm friends with Evan, and I think he's doing a good job over there. And what's interesting to me is that even if you look at your bottom line, so they become the Starbucks for Republicans, they still only gross like $200 million. Now, look. Evan's doing great. Black Rifle Coffee's doing great. Starbucks market cap is what? I mean, like, yeah, but I don't even know. Like,
that's right? A straw man. It's a much younger company and, you know, takes a while to sort
of, yes, yeah. But I still think that the market size and the market buying power of the downwardly mobile, quote unquote, Republicans is going to be a lot less than the top 20% of the population. So I'm curious your response from that.
Yeah, MyPillow versus Casper or whatever.
Exactly. Why don't we just have wealth distribution and then companies will compete for, on an equal basis for all consumers?
Well, here's a couple things I'll say in response to that. There's a certain part, I'm deeply sympathetic to that line of argument. In fact, I am thirsting for a return to a polity where the left goes back to arguing about economic injustice. I think that is actually going to be unifying for our country. As a side note, because of where the right is today, a lot of the right's actually going to come right along with that. And you know, if I do write a next book, which I'm weighing, I have a lot to say about some potentially a radical policy agenda that could actually get us there. But put that to one side, I'm sympathetic. Wealth is a bullhorn. And that's actually one of the great sins that I didn't talk about in my response to Marshall, but I should mention with woke consumerism. Is that when you switch to a $1, one vote system, the people with more dollars get greater moral say, not just if you're a CEO, but now if you're a consumer too. If you have $2 in your pocket and you're engaging a consumer boycott, no one's going to really care about very much what you have to say. But if you're George Soros and you decide to engage in a consumer boycott of something that you used to buy a lot of, well, the business might go out of business. So I think that that's another point about equitable distribution. That's a critique from the classical, at least distributionist left, of sort of modern woke capitalist progressive orthodoxy. Now, I think that in that debate that I wish we could get back to, I would kind of come out on a slightly different side of that debate, in that I think that the debate we ought to be having is limiting the scope of things that money can buy rather than taking for granted the scope of things that money can buy to include everything, and then saying because money can buy everything, we ought to worry about the distribution of those dollars. But I think that's a fair debate. There's a deep debate. You know, John Rawls would come out on one side of that debate. You know, I can't speak for Michael Walzer or whatever might come out on a different side of that debate. But that would be the debate that I think we need to return to as a polity, rather than taking for granted that money actually, you know, ought to buy more than it should, in my view.
Can you talk about some specific ways about how to stop money from buying? So are we talking about state action? Are we talking about reforming corporate bylaws? Are we talking about changing the way that we teach this in schools? What do you think?
Well, I think it's all of the above in some measure. I'm trying to debate how much I want to bore you. Some of this
is a podcast.
Okay. Yeah. So look, I think that some of this is about restoring the original intention of institutions that were actually well created to reflect the vision that I'm describing to you. America was actually built on separating walls between the different institutions and spheres of our lives that we wanted to keep apart from one another. The separation of church and state enshrined in our Constitution, the separation of nonprofits and the for-profit sector and the church, for that matter, through tax deductions for 501c3 organizations, but that have to stay within their lane in order to retain that. So this stuff, if you look deeply, is deeply ingrained into our law. I think the same applies to corporate law, too. If you look in the 1800s and even early 1900s, you had to get a charter as a corporation that the state legislature had to pass as the equivalent of a statute. So for administrative reasons, they handed that over to the Secretary of State of every state to be able to say, okay, you could sign off on your corporate charter. But the vision of the corporate charter was to say that if you were going to get a corporate charter to build a bridge for profit, then if you try to build a toll road instead, you know, lose all the benefits of the corporation. You could even be sued for it. That's how careful we were about giving these great gifts and protections to corporations of corporate power. So a lot of what I propose in the book is rolling back some of these corporate privileges that have accidentally gotten hardwired into governmental regulation. One is, I think, limiting the scope of limited liability of shareholders when they abuse the corporate shield to be able to do more than actually the law was intended for them to do. If you're a corporation, if you're an individual and you go out in the street and you protest and you hit somebody on the sidewalk, you could be sued for it. But if it's Sagar Corp, somehow you're shielded from that liability. I don't think Sagar Corp should be advantaged relative to Sagar, the person, when he's engaging in social advocacy, even if we might say that's the trade-off we need if you're going to be pursuing the sale of coffee for profit. That's one example. Another example. Now let's talk about the corporate privileges that executives enjoy. There's a doctrine called the business judgment rule, which says that if you're a CEO or a member of a board of directors, you can't be sued, like as in your case doesn't even go to the fact-finding phase of the trial, if you're in good faith making a business judgment about what ought or ought not be done. And by the way, I think that's a good thing. Let's take in biotech in my world. You got to take risks. You got to make a business decision. Not all business decisions work out. If a director could be sued every time they make a bad business decision, nobody would want to be a director. That's fine. But it was only ever supposed to apply to business decisions. Nobody should be immune from being sued for making a decision about a social perspective. And by the way, the point that you guys have spent a lot of airtime on, you know, rightly so, on this might be how you maximize profit, actually, that's not what these guys are saying in many cases. They're saying this is the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. Was Coca-Cola's decision to teach their employees on how to be less white or to take a stand on Georgia's voting law explicitly, according to James Quincy, linked to the pursuit of profit? No. Okay. No, yeah. Well, I don't think that should be illegal. I don't think he should be barred from doing it. But I don't think he should have this special corporate privilege to say that if a shareholder Coca-Cola wants to sue him for it, he shouldn't have an affirmative defense called the business judgment rule that applies when he's not making a business judgment. Or Section 230, which I think is another corporate privilege, which is hard codified into our statutes, which says that actually, and by the way, Section 230 is really not super well understood by a lot of people who bandy it about as a term. Section 230C2 literally says that these companies cannot be sued in state court, even for removing speech that is, and it's the only statute of its kind that I know, that uses the words otherwise constitutionally protected. As in, it was explicitly passed by Congress to sidestep a constraint imposed on Congress by the Constitution. They actually wanted it to apply to softcore porn, which was deemed to be constitutionally protected, but they wanted these companies to be able to remove it. But now it's being used to apply to political content. That's another corporate privilege to say that if you get this special form of governmental immunity, fine, you can get it, but I would reform Section 230 to say that if you opt in, make it an opt-in statute. If you opt in, then you're bound by the same constraints as the federal government itself.
Whoa. So the Section 230 stand here, I have to interject because obviously Section 230 applies to corporations, but also applies to everybody. And like, actually, this is my podcast. co-owned with Sagar, but I think I have a right to dictate what is on my podcast Discord. I think that I have the right to, if people are saying like anti-Semitic stuff or like racist stuff, I think I have the right to knock that down. So like, that's like, I think that's like the, I, so I
let's,
think, yeah.
Let's get into it though, Marshall. Let's get into this. Yeah. Okay. Cause
the
this
point,
is
I'll just to hit, yeah. Because the point
we,
is that
I like, think we should have the Section 230 discussion, but yeah. We can come back to it. But I'm just giving you a list of,
yeah.
A list of codified distortions to the free market in the true state of nature, without which, you know, maybe people wouldn't have started their businesses in Silicon Valley to a barbershop if limited liability or Section 230 respectively didn't exist. Fine. But my point is we need reforms that restore the integrity of those original intention of those statutes, as opposed to the ways in which those privileges have been expanded through the back door to encompass and protect far more behavior than they were intended to protect in the first place. And then I think we have a tort system in courts that can actually work out the rest in the ways that ordinary statutes work out disagreements between ordinary people, be it in contracts or people living their day-to-day lives. So that's kind of my general vision. It's not an end-all be-all, but to the extent of you're asking about categories of solutions, those would be in the category of legal solutions.
I understand what you're saying. Yeah.
That's different from cultural solutions, different from education, all of which are part of the equation, Sagar. But
got it.
That was the rabbit hole that we went down there. I wouldn't mind having that Section 230, you know.
Well, yeah. I mean, I
go
think
ahead, Marshall.
The Section 230 one's important just because I disagree with the characterization you're making, because you were referring to the fact that corporations also benefit from Section 230, as if the intention or the prime fact here is that the corporations are benefiting. From my perspective, and this is the perspective that anyone on the right should really consider, actually, like right-leaning people really benefit from the status quo of Section 230. Because my view on this is like, look, are Twitter and Facebook bad faith when it comes to social media moderation? They obviously are. Like, it's really funny that liberals understand the idea of like structural racism, but they also don't understand the idea that if structurally 9 out of every 10 moderators socially liberal, by definition,
structural political discrimination.
Yeah, it's the same. The idea should fit against both directions. So I'm not disagreeing with that part.
Right.
But I really do object to this idea that like most conservatives should be afraid to act on these social platforms, because actually I think the status quo is actually pretty good for 9 out of every 10 conservatives. And that's probably being a little, I think, underplaying what the status quo is. So I think what my point is without Section 230, if there wasn't the lack of liability, you'd see much more moderation you see today. Because
I'm familiar with all this stuff, and I think you're making some good points.
But that's the important thing though, because I'm also speaking to the listeners here. Because I think the key point is it's just portraying Section 230 as only benefiting corporations, I think misses the nuance of why this is an issue in the first place.
And well, I guess, I want to characterize my position there. I was lumping a lot, you know, limited liability in the business judgment rule. Limited liability is a distortion that protects corporate shareholders. The business judgment rule is something that protects corporate executives. Section 230 is a distortion that protects a certain class of companies at the expense of others, those who are namely internet service providers, rather than companies that are, let's just say, conventional publishers. So I wanted to clarify my position.
Could you explain the internet service provider part?
Yeah, sure. So, first of all, it only applies to companies that have a website. So it only applies to people who have a website. So I think it's worth, let's just pause for a second on what Section 230 is, right? Because I think that too much of this debate is like so many debates suffers from a problem of language and definition. So it's a statute that is two things. The first thing it does is it says that a social media website or just a website of any kind is not responsible or liable for the content posted on their websites. That's effectively C1. All right. You know, it kind of makes good sense to me in the sense that you're a telephone company. You're not liable for what somebody's defaming somebody else via the phone. You shouldn't be liable as a telephone company. Same thing goes for a new age version of a telephone company on the modern internet. You're not liable for providing the infrastructure through which people communicate. That's C1. C2 is the Good Samaritan provision, which says that, furthermore, you also can't be held liable, for example, in state court. It's a preemptive statute. So it says you can't be held liable in state court for taking down content that is otherwise constitutionally protected. And what they were responding to in 1996 was a doctrine around First Amendment protections for certain categories of lewd, lascivious content, certain kinds of pornography that may have still enjoyed constitutional protection. That's what the original intention was. Now, let's sort of take this discussion beyond the, you know, and I understand we, it's good to bring the listeners up to speed, but let's sort of go a layer beyond the whole, you know, narrative that exists in the bounds of debate today. There's a lot of political discrimination in our country right now, including at Facebook, including by employers, including at Twitter, including the content moderators. You just alluded to the same thing. So Florida, the state of Florida, passed a law. It's an anti-discrimination statute that says that if you're a social media company of a certain size, you cannot, it would be illegal, you'd be fined if you engage in political discrimination in selectively taking down certain political content, but not others. You could debate whether the statute's really well drafted or not, but that's what a state has made a decision to say. And then a federal district court, is all pretty recent, says that actually, I'm going to enjoin that statute. And by the way, it's a really well-heeled group of big tech consortium that went and brought the suit with really good lawyers that had the statute enjoined by saying that actually, Florida can't do that because Section 230 preempts it. My view, and this is something that I've argued in a series of Wall Street Journal op-eds this year, most recently, you know, earlier this month, although this is a side piece of that op-ed, Section 230, if it is construed to preempt a speech protective statute passed by a state, is arguably unconstitutional. And I'm not the only one who thinks it. Read between the lines of Clarence Thomas's recent opinion in Biden v. Knight. Read a footnote in particular where he refers to an article by Eugene Volokh, which refers in turn to an article that I wrote in January. That's actually the meat of the issue. So I don't think that the essence of Section 230 in its original intent was something that would merit a debate, though I personally think it wasn't a great law when it was passed. But the way in which that has been abused to apply and be construed far more broadly than was either envisioned when it was originally legislated or when today, in this third dimension we haven't talked about, is combining with state action to conspire to allow the government, the U.S. government, to do through the back door what it can't directly do under the Constitution by threatening companies like Facebook and Twitter to take down content that they don't want to see online. Jen Psaki is now boasting about it. So I used to write about this stuff. People said this was a conspiracy theory. It's not a conspiracy theory anymore. They're saying in the open and they're boasting about it. And by the way, immunizing those same companies from liability for doing that very thing. And so if you use both the stick and the carrot to do through the back door what you can't do through the front door, the O.J. Simpson trial version is if the glove doesn't fit, you must acquit. Well, for me, if it's state action in disguise, then the Constitution still applies. And if you want to talk about it on the left, this is a little bit of a mind bender, so stay with me for a second. Imagine the Section 230 is part of a statute called the Communications Decency Act. All right, let's make a different one. I could do five versions of this, but I'll do an abortion one. Let's call it the Childbirth Decency Act instead. So there's wear the hat of the left here. Okay, there's a constitutional protection of privacy in the due process, substantive due process clause of the 14th Amendment as codified in Roe v. Wade, which says there's a constitutional right to an abortion. Fine. All right, Republican-controlled Congress says that we're not banning abortion. Everybody sit down. But we are passing the Childbirth Decency Act, which says that you are immunized from liability in state courts if you engage in barricading an abortion clinic. You can actually even use violence too, by the way. Assault, battery, trespassing laws, they don't matter. You can barricade an abortion clinic. But we're not banning it. We're just letting private actors do what they do. Oh, and then by the way, we hold some hearings every quarter and we call CEOs of the barricade companies in and say, hey, if you don't barricade hate behavior at abortion clinics and misuse of life at abortion clinics, then we're going to come after you. We're going to penalize you. We're going to regulate you. We're going to break you up. And then those private barricade companies go out to abortion clinics and barricade them. Nobody's going to say that's a private company acting as a private company. Liberals would instantly see the constitutional problem. That is exactly what's happening with the combination of threats and ultimately immunity that the government's provided through Section 230. So, to Sagar's point from earlier, yeah, it's a question of positionality. Somehow constitutional problems become really apparent in relief when you sort of see the substantive issue that's at issue from the political opposite side. But I think that's the essence of what's going on today, and it's a problem.
Thanks for, I really was stopping you on the audience side because we've made it 150 episodes without a Section 230 debate. So I'm like, no, and it's actually kind of impressive we made it. So I'm like, let's define
it's
it.
It's necessary. Yeah. Thank
yeah,
you.
So let's just ask the last big question here, which is basically, I want you to write your second book. You're really smart. This is really impressive and interesting.
give us in like 60 seconds what you're like, because you said that you have some radical things. What is just like your 60 summary? And this is to push you to do the book, right? Like, what is your articulation, elevator pitch of like what you're thinking about as you're thinking about the country?
So I think that the hardest question of our time is the one that we need to answer. And I can't remember a time in my life where we more badly need an answer to that question, which is what it means to be an American in the year 2021. I think we lack a good answer to that question. I think our absence of an answer to that question is the black hole at the center of our nation's soul. And I think the beginning of that answer begins with the revival of the pursuit of excellence in our country. Excellence as individuals, excellence in the pursuit of each of our institutions, excellence in our democracy, excellence in our system of free enterprise and capitalism. And I think that the connection between what I just told you and some of the radical policy ideas that I have in mind will be what it takes a book to explain. But I'm thinking about ideas ranging from universal civic service being woven into the fabric of primary education. Side note, taking aim at summer break. That doesn't mean an extra year. Just use summer break, a vestige of teachers' unions that creates systemic inequity in the education system. We can talk about that another day. To actually a revised vision of some of the issues Sagar was asking about. He said Crystal was interested in, right? About economic distribution. Let's think about the role of inheritance and a system of taxation that's neutral. Maybe you like high taxes, maybe you like low taxes, but I sure as hell would rather live in a country where we made it a lot easier for people to accumulate wealth with a lower flat income tax to realize the American dream. As long as we know that it's coming back and somebody doesn't start in the next generation 60 miles ahead of the person who they were born next to and still call it a free country where we're competing according to equality of opportunity. And so I don't know if those are policies from the left or the right. I think there's such a vacuum on the right that that I think that the new conservative agenda ought to rally around new Americanist policies where each policy is narrowly tailored to reviving a fundamental new American ideal. But that's the kind of thing that I have in mind, whether it'll take the form of a new book or a movement that follows in the back of Woke Inc. You know, I think that's where we need to take this to a positive solution, because indicting a problem is easy. That's what I do in 80% of the book. You know, I kind of leave off at the end for what I think the beginnings of a path forward look like. But I would be disappointed if it just stopped there. I hope this is really the beginning of that movement to fill that void in our country.
Yeah. Vivek, here is the only thing I will beg of you as a person of means who has ideas. Please do not start a lame think tank. Yeah, that is the number one request that Sagar, our audience will ask. Please do not start a lame Cincinnati-based think tank that will publish lame white papers that no one reads and creates this whole. I'm shading 80 different people when I say this, but
all
seriously,
of whom listen to the podcast. Sorry, guys. Yeah.
But thank you, and please don't do that.
I'm thinking about a lot of things that's not at the top of my list. So
good.
I'll take that advice under advice.
This is actually pretty useful. Yeah,
I appreciate that.
It's been really great talking to you, man. Thank you for making the time. I learned a lot from it, and I hope you write that second book. I really mean it.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
Hope you guys enjoyed the episode. Reminder, Substack, subscription, bookshop, book purchases, and most importantly, realignment conference signups. Not everyone who applies is going to be able to make it, but we'll definitely put stuff together in the future because we're getting so many awesome people who are reaching out. And of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you next time.